Power Records presents Power Records presents.
We are in a communication center housed in a cave of ice beneath the surface of a frozen, mist-shrouded planet somewhere in space.
Power Records presents.
You hear what? I don't hear anything unusual.
A sort of strange, haunting music. It's been coming in on an interstellar frequency, softly intermittent, but at regular intervals, as though it were a message, perhaps a call for help.
Icy Robots presents Power Records Playhouse.
Join us as we journey back to a time when the power of imagination ruled. Here, we'll explore the worlds of classic Peter Pan and Power Records, from the exciting to the whimsical and everything in between. So, sit back, relax, and let the Power Records Playhouse transport you to a world of captivating stories and unforgettable characters.
Hello everyone, this is Petey Power here for another episode of Power Records Playhouse. This is the start of a real fun episode. We are going to take a listen to a Man-Thing record. He's my favorite Swamp Thing knockoff character. My second favorite is the team of Marshman and Bayou Boy. They are a bit obscure, but are still pretty cool. This week, we have something really cool, a very hard-to-find Tom Thumb record story. We will get to that in a second, but first, the Man-Thing. It's numbered PR16 and came out in 1974. Let's give it a spin.
Power Records presents Man-Thing in Night of the Laughing Dead. A swamp, a bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, but the serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with strange forces in the swamp to make you over into the Man-Thing. But your former existence seems a far-off dream to you, doesn't it? Less than a dream, in fact. No longer able to reason, you now function on emotion, those few which you still feel. You can feel what others feel. You can understand those feelings. But emotions are often as ambiguous as words, and sometimes they are even more so. Consider this weeping clown, for example. What does he feel now as he raises a gun to his temple, as the tears roll down his grease-painted cheeks? You may never know, for across the marshland comes a single, devastatingly final shot. That prods you into action. You attempt to hurry to the source of the evil sound, but no matter, you are too late. It was too late before you began. And all you can do is stare through hazy, crimson eyes at the little clown's corpse and reflect on the buried fragments of memories brought to the surface by the ugly sight. You remember how the man you were fought to protect his scientific discovery. You remember more, the blinding moments of escape, the knowledge that he had to destroy the vial, and perhaps, at the same time, destroy himself. And so, Ted Salas did what had to be done. Memory. You recall the transformation, the mingling of the chemical with the swamp waters around him, the stark shock to his metabolism, and the bitter ending of his sanity. Slowly, mercifully, the memories end. And the man who was once Ted Salas, whose body has become that of a swamp-roaming creature, forgets again what once he knew. It's better that way. It's better. As those thoughts fade, your gaze falls upon something at the dead man's foot. But you wonder, could these little scrawls on this thin white leaf explain why the man took his own life? But wait, another flash of recollection from your former life. Funeral. Humans bury their dead, so this one must be laid to rest. And so you take the body deep into the marsh, while events take shape miles away that will transform this already somber evening into something more terrifying by far.
The only rooms left are my deluxe.
Come on, Richard, we'll find another...
Lady, not tonight. I'm exhausted.
I'll just bet. That'll be $22.40, including tax.
These two young people are Richard Rory and Ruth Hart. Two old friends of yours, Man-Thing.
Well, that was a hassle, wasn't it?
I'll say. I'll bet he's a reform school reject. But you know, I haven't got the energy to argue with him. Not now.
Maybe we can go to the carnival tomorrow.
Carnival?
Sure. See the trucks over there? They must be playing a town around here.
Boss, Mr. Garvey, Daryl's gone. Run away. We've got to go after him. We can't lose the show's only clown. And besides, he was terribly upset tonight. I'm afraid of what he might do. Please, Mr. Garvey, if he does something rash, you'll be out!
I'll be the boss of this three-ring loony farm, just like before, you hear? And if you don't like it, you can scram.
Holy cow, Ruth! Did you see that?
Richard, wait! You don't know...
Them's your options, Ayla. Either you... Huh?
Hold it right there, Buster.
Oh, run along, sonny.
You heard the man, Twipe. Scram. See? He's the boss. He's my boss. And I don't like nobody messing with my boss.
Oh, boy.
No, sir, I don't like it at all. Now, I'd advise you to blow while you still got legs to walk on. It ain't wise to get Trag mad at you twice.
Trag? The world's strongest man? Gosh, that's who hit me.
Whoever you are, you've got to get out of here.
She's right, Richard.
Please, take me with you.
Hey, boss, Ayla's leaving, too.
Step on it, lover. Trag doesn't look happy about this. In fact, I think he and DeBoss plan to follow us.
I don't care about them. I just want to find Daryl. My poor clown.
First, we find another motel. I've got to get to sleep. We can go Clarabelle hunting tomorrow, Miss... You haven't told us your name, Miss, or why you're looking for a clown.
I'm sorry. It's Ayla Prentice. I'm a high-wire artist with the carnival, and I'm trying to keep my clown from destroying himself. You see, I loved Daryl, but I betrayed him. He stopped laughing, stopped living, just wanted to die.
Stop! Pull over! There! That's his car!
Sure, okay.
There he is, and thank the Lord he's alive! Daryl! I'm here! Daryl! Daryl, what's wrong? Can't you see me? It's Ayla! Why doesn't he answer? He acts as if he doesn't know who I am.
Maybe his mind is just totally snapped.
That's so. It's my fault.
Whoa! Where do you think you're going? It's dangerous out there.
Let go of me. I have to go after him. It's my fault. He's like this.
Richard, look at this. I think it's a suicide note.
So Ayla's not exaggerating. The little guy is in a bad way.
To say the least.
Okay, then. We go. But slowly, carefully. Remember, the next log you step on could have teeth.
But as the three young people forge cautiously into the tepid waters of your home, two somewhat more sinister figures race along the swampside highway in pursuit.
Sure, I'm sure they took this road. I think.
You think? Ha! You don't know how, Trag.
Oh, boss, I try. Hey, boss, look it, up the road, there. It's the clown, dancing in some kind of spotlight. Only, where's the light coming from? He don't even look real. Boss, I'm scared.
Slow down, you fool. You'll hit him. We don't want to kill him outright. Swerve, you idiot, swerve.
I'm swerving, but we're going to hit that tree.
The truck's gas tank explodes on impact, and the vehicle becomes a Nova Bright Inferno. And the little clown stands watching, gleefully.
Good evening, Trag. How are you? I am fine. Where is Garvey?
Laughing. Why, you little punk. When I get out from under this...
You'll kill me. Make me die. Where's Garvey?
You blasted right, I'll kill you. I'm mad now.
Oh, my. He's mad. But he'll still have to catch me. And he can't, because he's too big and slow and stupid.
Maybe. But at least I ain't no walking joke.
And not too far away.
Listen, voices. It sounded like Trag.
I didn't hear anything. Are you sure?
No. It's hard to be sure of anything in here.
I didn't realize it would be this dark. There are so many little sounds, so many shadows. It's... Oh! That's no shadow. It's some kind of... Here. Oh, whoa. Someone! It's got Daryl!
Holy cow! It's the man thing! Take it easy, Ayla. I know this is hard to believe, but that creature won't harm us or Daryl. If that is the clown he's holding, he may be protecting him.
And so, we better not startle him.
Right. We'll move closer, slowly.
And so, not suspecting that the man they seek to save is already dead, they inch their way through the dense swamp growth toward the spot where you stand. The hunk of earth you have chosen for the man's final resting place. And when they push aside the last clump of green, when they see the clown's limp body and the heavy branch in your mottled hand, Ayla draws the logical but wrong conclusion and panics. Heedless of the seeming danger you present, she rushes to the side of her fallen friend.
Daryl, wake up! It's Ayla! Daryl! Oh, no! He's dead! Dead!
You can feel this woman's deep sorrow. Your own head bows. But then, another powerful emotional force makes you whirl, startled.
How could you? I'd almost come to think of you as human. But now, get out! Get out of here, or I'll...
Anger aimed directly at you, emanating from a man you assume to be your friend. Why? What did you do? Why does he loathe you so? You cannot reason. And even if you could, you lack the vocal mechanism with which you might explain to them their error. So you merely skulk away. Once you have gone, tears flow copiously.
I didn't believe the man thing was capable of this. In fact, it still strikes me as odd that I could face him down so easily. Unless...
I never told him how I felt. I'm so ashamed.
Oh, wow! How could I have been so blind?
Ayla, look. He's been shot. The monster didn't kill him.
But that's impossible. We didn't hear any gun go off. And we just saw Daryl alive a few minutes ago. Didn't we?
You know, I'm beginning to wonder about that.
So am I. We all saw something back there. But what?
A ghost, maybe.
Come on, Ruth. Under the circumstances, isn't that a little bit morbid?
Nice try, twerp. Play acting that clown's dead to protect them from me.
Trag!
Come on, clownsy. Stand up and get beat to death like a man, you hear?
Stop it, Trag! You can't kill a corpse. Trag, I said stop it!
You said... Why should the world's strongest man care what you said?
Perhaps you are the reason Trag should care. For despite your puzzlement at his earlier outburst, you still know Rory as a good man.
Who's the lug in the gorilla suit?
And Trag's assault upon him enrages you.
Whoever he is, he ain't on my side. So he must be on yours. So... He's a blasted living slime pool. But if he figures that's gonna stop me, this is a challenge for me. I know I can take any man, but a monster, that's something new. I sliced right through him.
He has torn from you some small bits of your being, yet still you stand, to all appearances, unharmed.
I tore into you, ripped you apart, and you didn't even
You are waiting for one reaction, fear. For if this man or any man fears you, your very touch can burn his flesh to ashes. But Trag is not afraid, only amazed. He attacks again. But this time, it is your strength which prevails. And in the absence of fear, you resort to other even more brutal means to destroy your foe. But the memories return once more, the visions of needless, wanton slaughter. And though your instincts advise you otherwise, you allow him to live. And as you make that choice, the most bizarre event of this night occurs.
Holy leaping! What is it? What's happening to him? Or is it happening to us? Are we all losing our minds?
The warm night air has suddenly turned chill. As you stare along with the humans at the skeletal specter that has risen from Daryl's lifeless shell.
What are you? What do you want?
Why, I want to make you laugh. I want smiles and guffaws and grins and good cheer. And most of all, peace. What does any clown want but to make people happy? But I could not go on making others laugh when all I felt inside was pain, when the love I gave was not returned. But now, my soul is free! I shall feel mortal pain no more, and so I can laugh forever!
You look and listen to the specter of a clown before you. And all that you know, Man-Thing, is that never has laughter made you feel so sad.
Wow, that was wild. It actually had a suicide at the beginning. Kids' records were very different back in the olden days. That's what makes it so fun, I guess. Up next, we are going to move a little bit into the world of book and cassette sets. They came around in the 80s and revolutionized the world of children's audio. This one stars Hollywood superstar Mr. T, and it's called Mr. T and the Mystery of the Golden Medallions. If it were me and there were missing gold chains, I'd probably consider Mr. T a prime suspect. That guy really likes gold chains. Let's give it a play and see how it turns out.
This is a Mr. T adventure story. You can follow Mr. T and his gymnastic team friends, Miss Bisbee, Robin, Jeff, Woody, Kim, and Spike, in your very own book. It's easy. Read along. When you hear this tone, it means turn the page. Now, here's Mr. T.
Mr. T here. Have you ever been the new kid at school or in the neighborhood? It isn't easy to be the new kid. Woody Daniels knows all about that. Woody had a rough time when he first joined our team. We were in San Francisco for an international meet when we ran head-on into some video pirates. It was Woody who helped us nab them. We call this case The Mystery of the Golden Medallions.
The crowd watched breathlessly as Woody Daniels began a high, twisting dismount from the rings. The international gymnastics meet was almost over. Woody had given a nearly perfect performance. As Woody landed, the crowd jumped up, cheering and whistling. He ran to the sidelines where Mr. T and the rest of the team waited. The judges held up their scores, and the crowd cheered again.
With a high score of 9.9, the gold medal winner is... Woody Daniels!
Exclaimed the announcer.
Let's give that young man a big hand!
Great job, Woody,
said Mr. T. Woody looked at his teammates, but they sat quietly talking to each other.
Pooh, he's not that great,
said Robin O'Neill. She turned to Mr. T.
As a matter of fact, he's just having a lucky day, right, Mr. T?
No way, Robin,
said Mr. T.
Woody may be new to the team, but he knows what he's doing. He can add a lot to the team. Give him a chance.
Woody and the second and third place finishers made their way to the awards platform to receive their victory medals. As everyone watched, a mysterious hand reached out from behind the display area, snatched up the gold medallions, and disappeared.
Oh, no! Judge Wilson cried out. The medallions are gone! Quick, catch that thief! There he goes!
Spike caught a glimpse of the thief heading for the back door. He raced through the crowd after the thief. In an alley behind the gym, Spike discovered not one, but two thieves, dressed in black, kneeling on the ground. One was smashing the gold medallions with a hammer.
Hey, we got company,
said one of the thieves.
Grab that kid and let's get out of here, fast.
Let go of me,
shouted Spike.
Help! Help! Robin, help me!
Hey, did you hear that?
Asked Robin.
That sounded like Spike.
The team rushed out into the alley. Just as they arrived, they saw Spike being whisked away in a big blue van.
Look at this,
said Jeff.
The thief smashed all the medallions.
Maybe something was hidden inside, said Woody as he reached for a piece of paper laying on the ground.
Look, there's three addresses listed here. I'll bet those men were planning to go to these places.
That makes sense,
added Jeff.
The first address is this gymnasium.
Let's split up and check the last two out,
Robin suggested.
Jeff, Kim, and I will head to the second address. Mr. T, Woody, and Dozer can go to the third location. We'll meet back here at 9 sharp. Fair enough?
Asked Robin.
No, it's not fair,
sulked Woody, unhappy that his teammates didn't select him to join their group. Mr. T winked at Woody.
Come on, Woody. Let's get moving.
Robin, Jeff, and Kim were surprised when they reached their address and found a large old castle.
Boy, this place gives me the creeps,
said Kim. The front door was unlocked, so the team entered and quietly climbed the stairs. They emerged on a balcony.
Look!
Cried Jeff excitedly.
There are the men in black.
They're smashing the gold medallions in that display case,
exclaimed Robin.
I'm going to find out what this is all about.
Robin grabbed a window sash and swung from the balcony, surprising the men in black. One of the men grabbed a large sword and made a thrust at Robin. Thinking fast, Jeff grabbed a huge urn and threw it at Robin's attacker. The urn knocked the man off balance. His partner grabbed him by the coat collar and pulled him outside. They jumped in their truck and sped away.
You have now come to the end of this side of the recording. Please turn it over for the conclusion of the story.
Meanwhile, Mr. T, Woody, and Dozer reach their destination, a fancy French restaurant. Inside, a snobby head waiter greeted them.
I'm sorry, sir, you're not dressed properly for our restaurant, and dogs are not allowed inside.
Look here, we're looking for some kidnappers, and we don't have time to change clothes,
Mr. T said angrily.
Now, are you going to let us in, or should Dozer here show you some of his tricks?
Dozer growled at the nervous waiter.
Oh, I'm sure we could make exceptions to our rules, said the waiter. Please, right this way.
Mr. T, Woody, and Dozer were led to the crowded dining room, where a presentation was being made.
The Outstanding Salesman of the Year is Herb Samuels. Congratulations, Herb,
said the MC, handing him a gold medallion. Suddenly, from the doorway, two men in black rushed in. They pushed aside the MC and grabbed all the medallions.
Hey, you,
shouted Mr. T.
Stop right there.
One of the thieves grabbed a waiter and shoved him into Mr. T's path. The waiter dropped his tray, smashing glasses and dishes everywhere. In the confusion, the thieves escaped out the back door. Mr. T and Woody helped the waiter to his feet.
Mr. T, it's almost 9 o'clock,
Woody said.
We better get back and see what the rest of the team found out,
said Mr. T. At the gym, the team members were worried.
What have those evil men done with Spike? And what do they expect to find inside the medallions?
Asked a troubled Robin.
Hey, I've got an idea,
Woody exclaimed.
Let's call Judge Wilson and find out where the medallions were made. Then we can go there and find out if they know what the men in black were looking for.
Woody called Judge Wilson for the address. Within the hour, the team arrived at the Medallion Company warehouse. Peering through a window, they saw Spike and an older man. They were gagged and tied. Inching closer to the door, the team heard voices.
All right, we got the microfilm. Now all we have to do is sell it. And fast,
said one of the thieves.
What about the kid and the old man?
Asked another.
Get rid of him,
snarled the first thief. The team moved with lightning speed. Mr. T knocked down the door. The thieves tried to run. Jeff and Woody nabbed one. Mr. T grabbed the other. He lifted the frightened thief high in the air.
Going somewhere?
He asked. As the team tied up the robbers and waited for the police, the older man explained what had happened.
I'm Mr. Hansen, owner of the Medallion Company. These men forced me to hide some microfilm in a medallion, but it got lost in one of our shipments, and they've been looking for it ever since.
What was on the microfilm?
Asked Robin.
The secret designs for a new video game,
said Mr. Hansen.
The thieves were selling the plans to a foreign video company. These men are international video pirates.
Well, they won't be playing video games where they're going,
said Mr. T.
Right,
smiled Robin.
It sure is a good thing you thought of calling Judge Wilson, Woody.
Yeah,
added Jeff.
We never would have known to look at the Medallion Company for answers.
That's called teamwork,
said Mr. T.
Take it from me, Mr. T. Give the new kid a chance. Remember, you got to be a friend to have a friend. You never know. Someday you might be the new kid, and you'll appreciate a warm welcome from the rest of the team.
That one was pretty good. I appreciate how they got the real Mr. T on the cassette. He really added a nice flavor to the stew. I think T is an underrated voice actor. A little known fact is that Mr. T did the voice of Optimus Prime on the Transformers cartoon. It's either him or Peter Cullen. I get them mixed up all the time. Which one played B.A. Baracus on the A-Team? I think it was Cullen. Anyhow, up next we have another audio cassette. This one is a Masters of the Universe story called Mask of Evil. I'm a huge fan of Fisto. I hope he makes an appearance. Let's find out together.
This is your Masters of the Universe Listen and Lookbook. Every time you hear this chime, it means it's time to turn the page in your storybook. When you finish listening to this story, you can turn the tape over and record your own Masters of the Universe story. All right, now let's begin. There was great excitement at the royal palace of Eternia. The Lady Irina had come to visit, and she was an important guest. She had been childhood friends with Prince Adam and Teela. When Orko, the court jester, happened to pass the lady's chamber, he saw a surprising thing. Irina was sharpening a dagger. That evening, there was a royal banquet in honor of Lady Irina's visit. Orko said nothing about the knife, but he was still puzzled by it when he was called to entertain the king and his guests at the banquet.
Your Majesty, when I play on this enchanted flute, the rosebush will burst into bloom.
The eerie tune which Orko played had no effect on the rosebush. When the shrill notes vibrated against the king's wine glass, however, the effect was explosive.
You little wretch!
Screamed Irina.
Look what you did!
She seized her own goblet and hurled it at Orko.
Get back to the stables where you belong!
She cried. Orko dropped his flute and fled. Man-at-Arms picked up the magic flute and tucked it into his belt, where it could not do any more harm.
This is most unlike Lady Irina.
At the same time, in the corridors of the palace, Prince Adam hurried after the terrified little jester.
Orko, wait!
Cried the prince.
It was an accident. It wasn't your fault. Why did Irina act that way?
Prince Adam wondered out loud.
It's not like her. She's always been so gentle.
Gentle? Do gentle ladies throw things at innocent little jesters? There's something else, Adam. Before dinner, I saw her sharpen a dagger.
Said Orko.
Do gentle ladies need daggers?
Irina with a weapon?
Said Prince Adam.
From the time we were children, she has hated violence and weapons. This requires investigation.
With that, the prince hurried away to his room. Once in his chambers, Prince Adam seized the Sword of Power from its hiding place. He held it high and cried out,
By the power of Grayskull!
At the speaking of these words, the room blazed with light and roared with a thunderous sound. Prince Adam vanished, and in his place was the mighty He-Man.
I will go to consult the sorceress of Castle Grayskull,
said He-Man.
Perhaps she will understand this strange affair.
He-Man pointed his sword at Cringer. Magic flew from its gleaming blade. Instantly, his gentle pet tiger was transformed into the fierce Battle Cat. He-Man and Battle Cat raced through the night to Castle Grayskull. There, the sorceress, guardian of Grayskull, waited. She was always ready to help He-Man in his fight against evil.
I have been expecting you, He-Man, for I sense there is trouble abroad in our land.
He-Man told the sorceress of Irina's strange behavior.
Perhaps evil is masked by a fair face,
said the sorceress.
We shall see.
She waved her hand and a cloud appeared. He-Man gazed at the images in the cloud. He saw the banquet hall at the palace. There, he saw Irina entertaining the guests, playing for them on her harp. As He-Man looked closely at the images in the magic cloud, he came to a startling realization.
The king and his guests, they are all asleep. Irina has bewitched them with her harp.
That is not the Lady Irina.
The vision in the cloud suddenly changed, and the banquet hall was gone. In its place, He-Man saw a swamp. In the swamp, he saw a crystal globe where a maiden struggled in vain to get free.
That creature at the palace is an imposter,
cried the sorceress.
Here is the real Irina.
A prisoner of Merman,
gasped He-Man.
I doubt to stop it. But first I must return to the palace.
He thanked the sorceress and was on his way. He-Man and Battle Cat sped to the palace. They burst into the banquet hall and confronted the creature disguised as Irina.
Stand away from that harm, imposter!
He-Man!
He-Man's mighty sword of power flashed, and the harp was destroyed forever.
No! Not my harp!
The sword glowed with magical strength, numbing the creature's hand and forcing the dagger to drop to the ground.
My hand! I can't feel it! What have you done?
He-Man watched as the fair maiden shriveled and twisted and shrank away. Right before his eyes, she became a hideous beast.
One of Skeletor's demons.
Suddenly, Skeletor himself was there, and his loathsome henchmen were with him.
You come too late, He-Man,
said Skeletor.
The king and his guards sleep. The kingdom is mine.
What Skeletor did not realize was that the sleeping enchantment had ended when the harp was destroyed. The palace instantly came alive.
You rejoice too soon, Skeletor!
Shouted He-Man as the king and his guards seized weapons. Instantly, the hall rang with the sounds of battle, which quickly turned toward the favor of He-Man and his allies. Raging, Skeletor pointed his evil staff at He-Man. The sword of power slashed out, and the staff was torn from Skeletor's grip. His eyes blazing with hate, Skeletor had to retreat. And as he gave ground, his minions fled as well.
I will return, He-Man, and you will regret that day.
Then, just as quickly as he had appeared, Skeletor vanished in a burst of madness. The battle for control of the palace was over. The imposter was exposed and her enchantment broken. There was still one task remaining. With Teela and Man-at-Arms, He-Man raced to Slime Swamp. There was Irina's prison, just as He-Man had seen it in the sorceress's magic cloud. Merman was there, too, guarding the captive lady.
He-Man, you are wasting your time. You'll never save the maiden.
Merman fled, never being one to stand and fight. But he left the heroes with a difficult task.
The crystal bubble that holds the maiden is stronger than your sword, He-Man. Soon the air in the globe will be gone, and she will perish!
Merman's claim was true. He-Man slashed at the globe, but it would not break. He wondered if his lifelong friend would truly perish. Suddenly, a last desperate idea came to He-Man.
Orko's flute. The one he played at dinner. Where is it?
Here, but the shattered goblet, of course.
Do you think there's a chance?
Let us hope so, replied He-Man. It is our only chance.
He pressed the flute to his lips and began to play. The sound seemed to float toward the globe and surround it.
It's working. The globe is cracking.
And so, a long-awaited reunion finally took place. Childhood friends wept with joy at the safety of the Lady Irene.
So, Orko's simple magic has won over Skeletor's evil.
The next night, there was another feast at the palace, and again, the Lady Irina was the guest of honor. This time, it was the real Irina who sat beside the king and listened to the tune Orko piped on his marvelous flute. This time, the rose bush did burst into bloom. And this time, His Majesty sipped his wine from a silver cup so he could be sure it would not shatter.
Wonderful, said Prince Adam to Tiara.
She frowned.
Yes, today's magic is wonderful. Yesterday's battle was not. Where were you during that, Adam? Why are you always off someplace whenever there's fighting to do?
Perhaps I prefer magic to battles, said the prince.
Tilo let out a sigh of exasperation, turned back to the entertainment, and tried to enjoy herself. Prince Adam just smiled.
Well, there was no Fisto, but it was still a good story. Up next is a very rare treat. A little known fact is that over in jolly old England, they have their own version of Peter Pan records that they call Tom Thumb Records. Tom Thumb specializes in taking American properties and making them more palatable to the British ear. Their recordings never achieved American distribution, so they are very hard to find here in the States. In an amazing turn of events, I found this Tom Thumb recording of a Shaft story. Yes, Shaft, the black private dick who is a sex machine to all the chicks over at the next record store. Shout out to Jerry. Let's give this record a try. It's a rare treat, friends. Pay close attention.
This is Tom Thumb Records. Shaft and the Case of the Stolen Necklace.
I do say stop, you bloody muppet. My name is Shaft, John Shaft, and I'm bringing you into the Bobbies for murder.
No way, Shaft. I'll never surrender to you. You bloody tow rag. Get out of me face before I give you a right smack in the mouth.
You think you can smack me in the mouth, do you? You must be as thick as a castle wall, you Wally. Put 'em up if you have the sand. I challenge you to fisticuffs.
I accept your challenge, Shaft, but first I must warn you. I boxed at Cambridge and meddled in the students' game. It was only a silver, but the winner went on to take gold at the All Empire game. He knocked out two Irishmen and one proper Brit to win the medal. A right proper punch he had. Just give it up, Shaft. I'll put your face up in the dirt.
Well, I must warn you. I'm John Shaft, and I've never lost a fair fight to any man, be they a gentleman or like you. Three slices short of a loaf. Put your hands up. Let's fight. Good luck to you.
Good luck to you, John Shaft. Take this. Oh, bloody what? You dodged me best punch. Try this one on then. Oh, you bloody Drago. That hurt. All right, I'll give. You didn't have to hit me in the face. I was only playing.
Well, you bloody chuffer. You should know. Shaft, John Shaft, don't bloody play now, does he? Now get down on the ground and put your hands behind your back. I'm not the police. I'm an inquiry agent hired by the old bird you robbed last week. She wants me to break your arm, so now your arm is going to get broke.
Please, Shaft, don't do it. I'll tell you anything. I know everything going on around here. Just let me up and I'll tell you where all that old lady stuff went. You can get it all back. Just let me up, please, Shaft. Please.
Or we can do it like this. I break your arm and then you tell me where the stuff is, before I break the other one.
You may now turn the page.
Wow, that was nuts. He broke that guy's arm. I wonder how they made that sound effect. It sounded like the twisted celery stalk or maybe a bundle of sticks. Either way, it was very disturbing. Hopefully, we can come across more Tom Thumb records in the future. I've heard tell of a Dukes of Hazzard record where they jump an Aston Martin over the Thames River. Sounds great. Our final record today is called Dune, Attack of the Sandworms. I've never read Dune. Is it good? Why are the worms so big and what even is spice? Maybe they will explain that on the record. Let's give it a look-see and find out.
This is your Dune read-along book. Every time you hear this chime, it means it's time to turn the page in your storybook. Now, if you are ready, we will start Dune, Part 2, Attack of the Giant Sandworms. Don't forget to turn the page every time you hear the chime. It seemed to Paul and Lady Jessica that things could get no worse on the planet Dune. Duke Leto, his father, and her husband had been killed by the evil Baron Harkonnen. And now, mother and son were stranded in the desert, wandering toward safety or toward death. As they looked out over the sand, Paul pointed to a rocky cliff in the distance.
"We'll be safe up there," he said. "But if we journey over the dunes, the sandworms will surely devour us."
Part of their survival gear included a thumper, a machine which beat on the sand and drew the attention of the sandworms. Paul set the thumper in motion behind them, and he and his mother hurried away from it over the slippery sand. They had gone only partway toward the cliff when they heard the hissing of a sandworm. The sand began to shake under their feet. Moments later, the thumper stopped.
"Run, mother!"
shouted Paul as a hill of moving sand chased them.
"Run, or we're doomed!"
With only seconds to spare, Paul and Jessica reached the rocky cliffs just as the huge worm burst through the sand and began swallowing the rocks below them. The gigantic worm continued to smash his head against the cliff, desperately trying to reach Paul and Jessica before they climbed to safety on the higher cliffs. Just as they reached a high bluff and safety, a bolt of lightning lit up the cliff, exposing a large band of Fremen, Dune's people. The Fremen studied Paul and Jessica, trying to decide if they would be useful to them. Finally, Stilgar, the leader, spoke.
"The boy goes with us. But the woman will use too much water in the desert. She must die."
With that, he drew his knife and turned on Lady Jessica.
"Stop!"
Jessica commanded. The voice froze Stilgar in his tracks.
"Leave them alone," he ordered. "She's a Bene Gesserit. Her power will kill me."
Johnny, a lovely Fremen girl, approached Paul.
"What are you called?"
she asked.
"Paul is the name my father gave me."
"You must have a Fremen name as well. We shall call you Paul Muad'Dib."
Stilgar and the Fremen led Paul and Jessica across the desert, traveling a night and a day, until they reached Sich Tabar, their hidden underground fortress. Climbing down the deep, dark steps, they finally came to a huge black lake.
"This is only one of thousands of lakes we possess on Dune," explained Stilgar. "Soon, all this precious water will transform our desert world into a paradise."
Weeks passed. Paul and Jessica were becoming more comfortable in the Fremen world. The Fremen, in turn, were beginning to look upon Paul as their new leader, the one their legend predicted would come from another world to lead them against the cruel Harkonnen. Standing on a rock ledge in the Fremen Hall of Rites, Paul spoke to the assembled thousands of Fremen.
"We must destroy the Harkonnen and make Dune ours again. To do this, We must control the spice melange. The Baron and the Emperor himself need the spice and will have to come to us for it. We will be ready for them when they do.
Al-Muad'Dib, asked Stilgar. We will need special weapons to fight such evil.
I have such a weapon.
Paul held up a weirding module, the special voice box which he had used on Caladan and which he had rebuilt for the Fremen.
We will build more of these. I will teach you to use them. Then we will be prepared.
How does it work?
Paul chose a Fremen from the crowd and pointed to a nearby pillar.
Yell at that rock,
he commanded.
Ah!
The man yelled, but nothing happened. The other Fremen laughed. Then Paul placed the weirding module on his neck, turned toward the rock, and shouted,
Chuk-sup!
The stone burst into a thousand pieces with sudden explosive force.
We must act until no evil Harkonnen are left,
Paul cried out.
I will lead you, and we will become a vast army, ready to take back our world of Dune.
Months passed, during which the Fremen armies kept up their attacks. During this time, Paul's eyes had turned completely blue, like the Fremen's, from Dune spice melange. Then one day, Jessica gave birth to a baby girl, Alia, who was born with all her mother's Bene Gesserit knowledge and skills. Although Paul was now accepted as the Fremen leader, one test remained as final proof, a test of courage and skill. He had to ride a sandworm. Paul went out into the desert, set out a thumper to attract a sandworm, and waited alone on a dune. Soon, he heard the roar of the approaching worm. He stood frozen, holding a maker hook in his hands, and waited. Suddenly, with a deafening noise, the worm burst up out of the sand. It was huge, over 100 feet tall. Thousands of teeth glistened in the 80-foot circle of its mouth. Paul ran beside the sandworm and quickly hooked himself on its writhing, bucking body. The worm turned its body upward to keep the sand from hurting its exposed flesh. Then, in one swift motion, Paul planted more hooks in its breathing holes.
I've conquered it! Now I'm a sand rider!
He yelled proudly. Months became years. The sands on the planet Dune shifted in the wind. Paul grew into manhood as the Fremen's fearless leader. He continued leading his troops in raids on the Harkonnen spice mining operations. The Harkonnen losses of spice and equipment were piling up, and the Baron's nephew feared he could no longer hide them from his uncle. He screamed with rage.
I will find this Muad'Dib and suck the blood from him.
Millions of light years away, on the far side of the galaxy, Emperor Shaddam IV paced nervously in his golden room. The reason for his nervousness suddenly appeared before him. It was a first-stage navigator who had not yet changed into a third-stage navigator. The first-stage navigator's raspy voice filled the air.
Emperor Shaddam, you have failed miserably. This Paul Muad'Dib, whoever he is, still lives. The spices of Dune are in danger from his Fremen armies, and you and that bungling Baron Harkonnen are responsible. You must remedy this situation.
Muad'Dib is clever, but I will mount a full-scale attack,
promised the Emperor.
I will activate every legion I have and send them to Dune immediately. I will attack and destroy the Fremen rabble, and this new leader of theirs as well.
Paul knew that if he was to help the Fremen in their final battle against the Harkonnen and the Emperor, he would need great wisdom. He would need to see the future. The only way he could do that was by drinking the mysterious, all-powerful Water of Life. Chani, who had fallen in love with Paul, begged him not to.
Please, Paul, the water could kill you, for no man who has taken it has lived.
I have no choice, my love. It is my destiny.
So Chani went with Paul and his Fremen warriors out into the desert. There, he drank the water of life. Paul screamed as a thousand horrors filled his mind. But he finally awakened from his nightmare, having seen the future. Returning to the Fremen, Paul announced,
"The time of the final battle has come. I know a secret our enemies do not. I know how to destroy all spice forever, and I can now fold space as well. Now our enemies will fear me. Our time has come."
Paul and his Fremen warrior aides stood at the top of Arise, studying the Arakeen Palace and its defenses. They had been watching for days now and waiting. They had watched as the Emperor's forces landed and watched as his steel tent extended down below his own ship, serving as his palace and protective cover.
"Now is the time to begin,"
Paul said evenly, studying the sky.
"A sandstorm is developing, as planned, larger and more fierce than anything ever known before. And what about the sandworms?"
"They are on their way, Muad'Dib,"
a Fremen responded.
"We have put out thousands of thumpers to attract them. Just listen."
It was true. Their thumping roared across the desert like thunder.
"This will be a gathering of worms the likes of which no one has ever seen before,"
Paul exclaimed. And so it was. The desert sand rose like ocean waves as hundreds of worms approached. Waiting to ride them, hooks ready, were the Fremen warriors. Meanwhile, at the Arakeen Palace, Baron Harkonnen was ordered to rush to Shaddam's tent. The Emperor was angry.
"Your mistakes forced me to come here. Your cruel treatment of the people on Dune has caused a rebellion among the Fremen."
At that moment, a small girl in long black robes entered. It was Alia, Paul's sister. Alia announced,
"I am the messenger from Muad'Dib, Paul Muad'Dib, who is really Paul Atreides."
Before the Emperor and the Baron could get over their shock, loud explosions were heard outside the tent. Paul and the Fremen had begun their attack. Enraged, the Baron grabbed for Alia, but she jabbed a poisoned needle into his face, crying,
"Here's the revenge of the Atreides family!"
The Baron gasped and died as another huge explosion burst open the steel wall of the Emperor's tent. Harkonnen's fat body, which was floating in midair, was sucked out of the hole in the wall, only to be swallowed by one of the attacking sandworms.
"They have broken through the outer shield wall!"
Shaddam shouted in panic.
"I am under attack! Quickly, your majesty, into your ship for safety!"
yelled the captain of his personal guard. Alia laughed as she ducked out, escaping into the confusion of the battle raging around the Arakeen Palace. Thousands of explosions illuminated the sandstorm as it swirled over everything. And out of the darkness came the Fremen sand riders, hundreds mounted on each worm. The sandworms and their riders poured through the broken shield wall and scattered the terrified legions of the Emperor. Most of the troops were either swallowed or crushed by the sandworms, and those that were left met their fate at the hands of the Fremen warriors. When the victorious Fremen entered Arakeen Palace, Paul ordered his prisoners brought before him. Paul leveled his gaze at the defeated Emperor.
"I have true power now," he said. "I can destroy all the spice which gave you and the Bene Gesserit your special powers."
"How dare you speak to me that way?"
retorted the Emperor. Then turning to Fade, the Baron's evil nephew, Shaddam said,
"Here, Fade, take my knife and fight this Paul Atreides."
Fade took the Emperor's knife and stepped forward, opposite Paul. The two began to circle each other, each looking for a weakness in the other. Soon, they were rolling on the floor, grappling, each with a knife seeking the other's throat. Suddenly, Fade shifted his body and lifted his leg.
"Muad'Dib!"
Chani screamed.
"He has a poison dart hidden on his leg!"
Just as the dart was about to plunge into Paul, he flung his body to one side, and in the same movement, his own knife found Fade's throat. Paul rose to his feet, triumphant. Throwing down his knife, he announced,
I no longer need a knife or a weirding module, for I now can kill with a word.
The Fremen chanted,
Paul Muad'Dib, you are truly the leader our legend promised us.
Shani exclaimed. Paul's blue eyes shone. There would be justice and peace in the known universe at last. Suddenly, a downpour of rain, life-giving, life-sustaining rain, began to fall on Dune. And gathered outside the palace walls, jubilant Fremen raised their voices as one, in triumph.
Well, guys, we went a bit long this week, so I'm going to sign off with some haste. This is Petey Power saying, hope to see you soon. And until we meet again, be a nice person and go walk your dog. It gets bored sitting in the house all day.
This has been an IC Robots Radio production.
Do do diddly do 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 diddly do 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 diddly do do.
Trash Dusters.
This is Derek for the Santa Rosa Trash Busters Alliance. I was out at the park yesterday and I saw this old dude, a total boomer, toss his cigarette butt on the ground near the playground. I was there practicing my parkour. Anyway, I got so mad about this disgusting litter bug that I did a flip off the bars and picked up the butt before it hit the ground. Then I did two somersaults over the old dude and put the butt right into his front pocket. He didn't even notice. The fun part was that it was still smoking. I don't want to hope he got burnt, but if he did, so be it. Smoking is gross, but if you do decide to do it, put your butt in your pocket, but be sure to put it out first.
This has been an announcement from the Sonoma County Alliance to Stop Old Dorks from Tossing Cigarette Butts Everywhere Alliance.